In the Sundays leading up to Christmas this year, we're doing a series of sermons that we've entitled Perspectives, where we're looking at what certain major characters of the Bible, or not even major characters necessarily, but characters in the Bible story have to teach us about who Jesus is. And today we're coming upon some characters that are pretty familiar in pop culture, immortalized through the song We Three Kings, which I believe we're going to sing possibly in the second worship set today. It's worth noting that these guys probably weren't kings, and we don't have any reason to assume there were three of them, but they do have important things to teach us about who Jesus is. Because what we're going to see them doing is traveling in a very perilous, long journey to bow down and worship a two-year-old. And what's perhaps even more surprising about that is that they're not presented as crazy for doing it. In fact, not only are they presented as kind of acceptable, but as exemplary. Because the two-year-old that they were going to bow down to and worship was their shepherd king, and he's our shepherd king also. Worship the shepherd king. That's what we're going to talk about today, and we're going to see in this passage three reasons to do so. First, this shepherd king is your king. Second, he is unlike any other king. And third, he is a great king. So look with me at Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12. I'll read these verses out loud. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him." After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Okay, so the first thing we're going to see is that this king is your king. So let's get a little oriented to what's going on in the story here. So if these magi, as they're called in this passage, aren't kings, then what are they? Well, magi is a word that at this time referred to wise men or magicians of sorts, even astrologers or spiritual gurus in Babylon or Persia. We don't know exactly whether they're Babylonians or Persians, but the historical context suggests they're probably Babylonians. In either case, they're from a nation that's not necessarily friends with the Israelite nation, the nation that Jesus was born into and that this passage is primarily about, the Jewish people. And yet they were close by, and so they had contact with Jews, and somehow through that contact they must have become aware of a prophecy that there was going to be born a king of the Jews who would deliver the people, who would save the people from all their sins and sorrows, and that this coming of this king would be accompanied by a star in the sky. Now, you can see why that would be exciting for them, because as astrologers, they study the stars, and they hear a story of a king who's going to come, and the sign of his coming will be a star. What's interesting, though, is the great lengths to which they go to come and see this king. So I mentioned earlier that this is kind of a perilous journey, and like I said, we don't know exactly where they're from, but we know they're not from Israel, and we know Jerusalem is fairly inland from where the eastern border of Israel was. So this journey, some Bible scholars have estimated, could have taken them up to 40 days. So that means they're packing up all their possessions. They're probably having to hire or at least bring with them some type of crew who can make sure they're being provided for, who can make sure they're being kept safe. Travel in these days is much more perilous, so you're more prone to sickness, thievery, even the weight of the elements. You know, if you're in a bad dust storm or something like that in the Middle East, those kinds of things can be very disastrous to someone going on this kind of journey. All this, and when they get there, they tell them why they're coming, right? They say, "We heard that there's been born here the King of the Jews." So they travel all this distance to hear someone they call the King of the Jews. And why is that strange? They're not Jewish, right? They're going to see the king of a nation that they aren't even citizens of, and they're kind of putting their lives on the line in order to do it. It would be like me selling all my possessions, giving up my life here in Philadelphia to go take a long journey to see the new president of Tajikistan. I don't know. Like, just, I'm sure that guy's nice, but like, it just doesn't have much to do with my life, and so why would I do it? In America, half the country doesn't even get up out of bed to go to the polls on election day to vote for our president. And these guys are taking a 40-day journey to see the King of the Jews. Why? It's because the King of the Jews, while King of the Jews, was also destined to be king of all the nations. So this king is not just the king of a local people. That's where he begins. But he's destined to be king of all. And we see this, for example, in a passage like Isaiah chapter 9. Verses 6 through 7 of Isaiah 9 say this. And it's on the screen behind me here. It says, "For to us a child is born." This is an Israelite speaking, right? So they're saying to us, to the Jewish nation. "A child is born, to us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this." So it's saying this king is king on the throne of David. That's like a kind of shorthand way of saying he's the king of the Jews, right? But it also says, of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. Saying he will be king of the Jews, but his government will increase. But what's amazing about this king is that when his government increases, peace increases with it. It's not the dictator, you know, despot conquering the surrounding nations. It's the we'll get into this later, it's the shepherd king coming and shepherding the people who are in need of a shepherd. In any case, the point is that this king is a king who's given for all nations. And so, even when he's born here and when the star comes in the sky, as we're going to see in this passage, the only ones who acknowledge it are those who weren't even from the Jewish people, ethnically. And this is why, as Christians today, we need to be a people who are concerned about all nations, not simply concerned about our own. Because this king who has come has a government that will increase and will have no end. And his peace will extend to all of these nations. And so for us as a church, even here at City Light, it's not an option for us to only love our neighbors here in Philadelphia. Jesus isn't just king of Philadelphia. Jesus has come to increase his government throughout the entire world, to every tribe, tongue, and nation. And that's why as a church, we're sending people to proclaim the gospel in the Middle East. We got to hear from Marilyn Britt just a few weeks ago sharing her story of how God has called her and sent her. We believe that in this room today, God would take some of you from our midst to send you to bring the gospel to another area of the world that has much less access to it than we have here in America. And for the rest of us, we get to be the people who send them. We get to send them with our prayers, with our training, with our support, and yes, with our money, to make sure that this king is known in all the nations that he came to reign and to shepherd over. So this king is king over all the nations. Because when God created the earth, he created the whole thing, right? And from the beginning, when God made it, he created it to be a good kingdom. And in good kingdoms, what happens is all the relationships function properly and justly. People are at peace with the king. They're at peace with one another. They're at peace with even the land and the world that God has given us to care for and to rule over. But rebellion messes that up, right? When there's conflict with the king, there's conflict throughout the whole nation. And so what's happened in the world is that the world is now not the way it's supposed to be. And this is what Christians refer to as the fall. Since the fall, the world is not the way it's supposed to be. Since we have turned from God and run from him, the world's different now. But at the same time, God is always at work to redeem it. And since he created the whole earth, his plan for redemption also extends to the whole earth. So basically, if you want to know where is Jesus wanting to increase his government and his peace, just look for anywhere the world's not the way it's supposed to be. And that's all of it, right? There's no area of the world that's not affected in some way by this fall. Popular Christmas song, Joy to the World, which we'll also sing today, says he comes to make his blessings known far as the curse is found. Anywhere the curse is, Jesus wants to be king over that too. And Jesus is the rightful king over it, and we come announcing the good news of his kingship to anywhere the curse is found. Now, we don't know how much of that the Magi knew, right? They don't give us, you know, Matthew doesn't give us a biography of these guys and what their past experience. Maybe they know that Isaiah 9 prophecy, and that's why they know this is my king. But here's what we can be sure they knew, because we all know it too. They knew the world's not the way it's supposed to be. Have you experienced that in your life? Have you seen in your life that things aren't the way they're supposed to be? Like, things happen to me, things happen that I see, that I do things that I know. Something's not right here. Jesus comes to make his blessings flow right there, right where the curse is found in your life and in the world around you. So what's stopping you from seeking him? You know what the Magi knew. You know the world's not the way it's supposed to be. What's stopping you from going to him? What's the thing about which you say, a 40-day journey, but then I'd have to, what? What's the thing that seems just too important and too significant to part with in order to intentionally seek this king who is king over all? You can give yourself, you can give your time, your energy, your pursuits in life to your relationships, to your career, to your family, to a whole host of other things. And those can be good things. But here's the deal. None of them can make their blessings flow as far as the curse is found. You can achieve all those things, and your world will still not be the way it's supposed to be. It can't reverse the curse, right? Like, they can be good. But if they're preventing you from seeking the one who can, they're hurting you, ultimately. If you've experienced the curse in your life, if you know the world's not the way it's supposed to be, you need this king. Don't let anything stop you from seeking him. One thing that does often stop us is a kind of skepticism. We feel like if I really laid out my doubts and tried to deal with the questions I have about Jesus and the things that are holding me back, I probably wouldn't find the answer anyway, because who can really know, right? Like, Christians say Jesus is one thing, Mormons say he's another thing, Jehovah's Witnesses say he's another thing, Muslims say another thing, historians say another thing. And when you hear them talk, they all sound right. And so how can we really know what Jesus is like? But one thing this story shows us is that God is a God who actually wants to be found. He puts a star in the sky, right? Like, people can see this star. The Magi, when they set out hopefully, because they knew this star was in the place where they would find the king. And eventually in the story, God actually moves the star to the very place where the child is. This is a God who actually wants to be known. He's a God who can be found. And so you can seek him. Hopefully, you can seek him knowing that as I do so, he promises to reveal himself to those who do genuinely seek him. Like, astrology is not a positive thing in the Bible, right? Don't apply this and say, hey, I should go read my zodiac sign. No, like, you don't need that. But God reveals himself to astrologers through a star, right? And he can reveal himself to you. But to seek him today, we don't look for stars. Jesus was only born once, right? So this sign is unique. However, there are a couple things that are called the light for us today. And those two things primarily, Jesus' words and Jesus' people, are called a light for us. And so if you want to seek Jesus today, you want to know what he's like, you want to go deeper in knowing him, here's how you do it. You go deep into the Bible and you go deep into his people. Deep into a commitment to a specific local church and deep into understanding what has Jesus actually claimed for himself in the Bible. And as you do that, you pray, and you just tell God, I can't find you unless you reveal yourself to me. Would you do that? And that is a prayer that God is delighted to answer. So don't let anything stop you from seeking this king. He is your king. We don't have the luxury to just punt on it, right? The world's not the way it's supposed to be. Something has to be done. This is the king who's come to increase his government and his peace as far as the curse is found. Seek him. Second reason that we worship the shepherd king is because he is unlike other kings. So Jesus is born king of the Jews, but he's not the only king at this time. So you notice in this story, there's another king who's not so much a fan of this whole event. This guy's name is Herod. Herod was not from the royal line of Israel, but when the Roman Empire conquered the Jewish territory, they appointed Herod as king over the people. So now these wise men come and say, hey, we've heard there's a king that's been born in your land, of your country, and how do you think that's going to hit him, right? Well, it doesn't have to hit him the way it does, right? Like, if he really loves the people that he's ruling over, he should be excited about this, right? The king of the Jews, the promised king, is here, who's going to restore the people. But that's not his main concern, right? Like, and okay, he'd have to stop being king, but like, it's okay not to be king. All of us in this room aren't kings, and we're not like miserable as a result. But if your concern is for your own greatness, then yes, the threat of another is a big deal. And so it says in verse 3 that when he hears this news, he was troubled by it. And he goes about kind of hatching a scheme to kill Jesus, basically, to find some way to get at him. And while he's doing all this, look at how this king is described, the king that's been born. So he wants to find out about this story, and he calls in his kind of crew or whatever, his experts, and they tell him, yeah, you know what? This is actually kind of what was predicted. The Savior, the king, is supposed to be born in Bethlehem. But this is how that king is described. Verse 6 here. From you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So while Herod's here trying to hold on to his power, trying to make sure his greatness isn't threatened in any way, this king that's been born king of the Jews is described as a shepherd. Now, shepherds are not generally associated with royalty. Like, if Dirty Jobs was a show back then, shepherds would have made frequent appearances, right? Like, they're down in the mud and in the crap, literally. Like, they're herding a group of animals that are not known for their intelligence. Like, sheep, just on the spectrum of animal, there's like dolphins, and sheep are way down here, okay? And so that's their job, right? So they're providing food for these animals. They're finding a safe place for them to stay. They're guarding them from enemies and from predators. I mean, these guys are down in the weeds. It's a caring profession, basically. And that's how this king of the Jews is described. He's going to be the kind of king who loves, who feeds, who protects, who provides, who knows, who cares. Totally different from the way we see Herod described here. He's a king who comes as a baby, who comes as the most helpless of all possible humans, right? Totally dependent. Here he is, reigning as a king, as an infant. While Herod's seizing his power, this king has come and laid down his power and subjected himself to weakness, to fragility, right, to pain. And at no point is he more helpless and more weak than when his hands are nailed to a cross when he dies on our behalf. This good shepherd, in order to protect and provide for his sheep, had to lay his life down for his sheep. That was the only way that these sheep could be brought back into a right relationship with God. In order for him to make his blessings flow as far as the curse is found, he had to first bear the curse. Rather than find his enemies and kind of snuff them out and launch a scheme against them to kill them all, he dies for his enemies. Rather than prioritizing his own good at the cost of the nation, he prioritizes the good of the nation at the expense of his own, laying down his life on behalf of the people that he would be ruling. And did you notice when the Magi find him, they rejoice. They're described as exceedingly glad. Now that's weird if you think about what's happening, right? Like, how many of you, if you met someone and I said, hi, you know, Michael's here. Michael, I want you to meet this other person. He's going to rule over you now. Awesome! No, none of us are excited about that because we know how rulers normally operate, right? They use and abuse to get their way. And so we don't want to be under anyone's authority. But there are some contexts where you could be excited about that. So a TV show I love is called The Wire. Some of you have watched it. If you know me, you know I've been watching it for like 4 years now. Every time someone tells me about a new TV show they're into, I'm like, I'm still working my way through The Wire. It's not because it's bad. I can't find the time for it or whatever. But it's a really good show. And it chronicles some of the challenges that inner cities face. It takes place in Baltimore, but it kind of gives us a window into inner city challenges throughout the U.S., especially in Rust Belt cities. So Philly has a lot in common with some of the challenges Baltimore faces. And one of the storylines in it is they follow a police force, a group of police officers, who at some point create a major crimes division. And this major crimes division is fighting major crimes, but it's not great for crime statistics because they're always going after kind of the head honcho, and they're not arresting weekly just the corner drug dealers or whatnot. And so when another leader comes in, they want to shut this unit down, basically, because it's not helping their stats. So they put an incompetent leader in charge of it. And everyone under this incompetent leader suffers. Under the guy's name is Merrimo, and they all just hate working for him. But what happens at one point is someone else gets into power, and they put their old leader back in charge. So what happens is they get Daniels back, and they're all thrilled. They love it. Even though they've just been told, hey, this is Lieutenant Daniels, he's going to rule over you now. They're excited. They're rejoicing because they know with this leader at the helm, we will flourish. Our joy will be increased with this leader here. That's the kind of shepherd king that we're talking about here. That's the king unlike other kings, that when he takes control, when he takes the reins, you know, this is better. This is better than anything else. One of the challenges we have, Richard Herring shared here a couple weeks ago that he lived in Thailand and he got to live under an actual monarchy. We don't do that in America, right? And so the idea of being under someone else's authority, like we'd almost just rather say, let's just not be under anyone's authority, right? Like, why do we have to choose one boss or the other? Let's just not have bosses. But any of you who have jobs know that would not work, right? Like, it's actually a good thing to have management, to have someone who knows what they're doing, love you enough to assign tasks, use your gifts, and move the organization along towards a goal. Like, it really helps. Not only that, it's impossible to not have it. Like, if you try an actual world where you say, I'm just not going to be ruled by anything, let's get rid of rulers and everybody do their own thing, the more powerful people will just become the rulers, and they'll oppress the weak people, because there's no one above them who can stop them. What we need isn't a world with no authority and no rulers. We need a good ruler and a good authority who's out for the good of the people that he's ruling rather than for his own good. That's the shepherd king that we have in Jesus. That's the shepherd king that we're seeing in this passage, who is unlike any other king, the kind of king who lays down his life for his sheep. So if you find his commandments burdensome, like if you get confronted with what Jesus clearly says in Scripture, and you find yourself kind of squeaming, right, and just looking for a way out, looking for the loophole, looking to tune down the obedience a little bit, what does that say about your view of this king? If you think of Jesus as this kind of angry ruler, you're probably not going to worship him, right? You'll either look for a way out, you'll find the loophole, do the bare minimum, disobey, or you'll obey, but you'll kind of grit your teeth, right? You'll never rejoice and be exceedingly glad. And so if you notice for you, relating to God and following Jesus is mostly kind of a burdensome thing that weighs you down, it's probably because you're thinking of him as a king like other kings. And that's not who he is. He's a shepherd king who lays his life down for you. And that means his commandments for you are for your good. They're to protect you. They're to provide for you. Because this shepherd cares for you, and he knows you better than you know you. He knows what you need, and he's giving you words of life and of freedom. He's for you, and he's with you. Rejoice, right? Be glad at the words that Jesus gives us. Now, some of us don't have a problem viewing Jesus as an angry monarch because we don't view him as a monarch at all. We just don't like that image of him as a king. And that's why we also need to see this third reason to worship the shepherd king, is that he is a great king. He's a king unlike other kings, and he really is a king. So when the Magi come to see this king, did you notice what they do? They say they've come to worship him in verse 2. And this word for worship has a connotation of bowing down, of even kissing a hand. And so, like, imagine that scene, grown men coming. They estimate, you know, who knows how old Jesus was at this point, but he was a child, he was an infant. coming to a two-year-old and bowing down and kissing his hand, and bringing their finest possessions, their frankincense, their gold, their myrrh, and just laying them down, giving them in tribute to this great king. It's weird, but Matthew presents it as an entirely fitting response. And why wouldn't it be, right? If this is the great king, the king over all nations, the king whose government knows no end, from this day forth and forevermore, this is totally the appropriate thing to do. You bow down, you worship. Do you think about that when you pray? Do you think about that when you come to gather on Sunday mornings for worship even? That you're getting to interact with and have a conversation with the God of the universe, the King of all kings? Is there a sense of awe as well as a sense of intimacy, right? He's your shepherd king. You can come near to him, but he's your king. He's powerful. He's great. Their response also included this generous giving of their possessions. And notice no one had to tell them to do this, right? It's not like they showed up the door and Mary was like, hey, you want to see the king? It's going to cost you. No, like they knew we're going to see a great king. What else would we do, right? This is just the normal thing. And it's what you already do. We already give our money to whatever we think is great and awesome and wonderful. Just look at your bank account. Look at where your money goes. It'll show you what you think is truly great. If this is the great king, if this shepherd king is unlike other kings who laid down his life for you, then it just makes total sense that your money would just be given away to him. If he's promised to provide for you, what do you need to hold on to it for anyway? Like, have that internal argument sometime. Have that argument with friends. Why do I need to keep this money again? Oh, because you want to have it for a rainy day, but you have a shepherd who's going to be there on a rainy day, right? Well, no, I want to keep it so I can have this great experience, but your shepherd is going to lead you to the greatest possible experience. He's going to lead you to an eternity with God in a kingdom that can't be shaken. You start to find, like, actually not a lot of good reasons for me to hold on to this. I can just give it away as tribute to my king. Now, you can't go anywhere and find two-year-old Jesus to pay tribute to today. So when you pay tribute to the king, we do it by giving to what's described as his body here on earth, his church. So that's the kind of the first priority in our giving in Scripture is giving to our church. And this isn't just a plug for you to give to City Light. If City Light's not your home church, yeah, don't make us the priority in your giving. But if City Light is, then yes, the way you pay tribute to this king is you give generously to your local church. And then beyond that, he also calls us to use our money to give to those of his sheep who are less fortunate, who are in need. And then to also use our money to give to his hands and feet that are going throughout the world, those who are taking the gospel to these other nations. And the cool thing is when you give to City Light, you give to both of those things because we give 18% of our money that comes in right back out the door to what God's doing in people's lives, whether that's local needs financially, whether that's sending people overseas. So this is just a natural response to acknowledging the greatness of our king, is that we would have this kind of loose giving away of our possessions approach. But it's not the only response to the greatness of the king that we see in this passage. There is still Herod's response, right? And this is kind of the alternative. These are kind of your options when faced with the greatness of a king. You can either enjoy his greatness, submit to it, gladly just give your money away to it and worship him, or you can oppose it. And if your greatness is really important to you, that's what you'll do. That's what Herod is doing here. He doesn't want to lose his throne, right? He has to keep his position. He has to keep his power. Now, if I asked you, so do you think of yourself as great and awesome? Maybe some of you would say, yeah, because we're all great. You know, I don't know, like a positive thinking thing. But most of you would probably say, like, no, I'm not arrogant. You know, like, I don't think I'm so awesome. You know, like, I know we've all got our issues. But how do you feel about thinking of yourself as a sheep in need of a shepherd? How do you feel about thinking of yourself as the subject of a ruler and of a king? If you've built your life around climbing the ladder, if you've built your life around gaining independence, being the guy who's on top, being the kind of cool person within your social ladder or your social connections, getting into a certain level of association, then thinking of yourself as the subject of a ruler, thinking of yourself as a sheep in need of a shepherd, our pride just hates it. Like, you know, I say it and I think, I don't want to be that, you know, like be under the power of someone else, be less than the greatness of someone else. But again, like you could imagine scenarios where that could actually be really good news. So again, think of our police force, but imagine instead of being in the unit, you're appointed head of the unit. Like, imagine if they made me head of the Philadelphia Police Department's Major Crimes Unit. Nice gesture. I have no police experience, right? I would be clueless. So murder rates start climbing, drugs are all over the place, people are getting beaten. Manager's starting to get a little worried, right? The higher-ups at the police force are saying, yeah, you might lose your job here. Wife's freaking out a little bit because it looks like you're about to get cut. Mortgage maybe is going to go nowhere. I don't have a mortgage, but play with me. You're in financially hard times. You're feeling the weight of that. Like, imagine you get thrust into this thing that you just know, I cannot do this. And then your commissioner or whatever comes to you and says, we have a police officer who actually knows how to do this job, and he's going to take the reins. Oh, and he took a pay cut to take this role, and he's going to give you the leftover money. Oh, and he sold his house, and he's going to use the money to pay off the mortgage that you just defaulted on. How hard would it be to submit to that ruler? The only way that's hard is if you're still convincing yourself that you can do it. If you're still saying, no, I can make it work, right? And one of the hardest thing about submitting to Jesus is if you're still convincing yourself, I'm great enough. I can do it. I can make it work. And like, aren't you tired of that? Can you really make your blessings flow far as the curse is found? Even if you could fix your own life, there's a limit to what you can do, right? But the good news of the gospel, the central message of Christianity, is not only that you can't do it, it's that you don't have to do it. You don't have to keep it together. You don't have to make it work because someone else is here to take over. Someone else has come to be king, and this king is a shepherd king. This king is a king who lays his life down for his sheep. This king is a king who dies for his enemies to make them his friends. And he's here. He's here. He's born. And he's risen today to reign and to shepherd his people. Gladly submit to him. Worship and pay tribute to this king.